Welcome to MCBI's 60 Mark, a podcast for curious thinkers.
Hello and welcome. It's Marina here, and thanks for listening. I'm now going to be telling you a little story, and this is a part of our storytelling program of work, but it's also an opportunity to tell you a little bit about my story. So let me try to do this via a podcast. I've got a couple of visuals here in front of me, and I'm going to try to describe them as I tell you the story of how I got to be the managing director of MCBI in 2019. Now, if many of you sort of met me now, you'd probably see a suit and you'd be forgiven if you had a look at my LinkedIn and you were like, oh, wow, look at all those amazing credentials and achievements. And don't think for a second I'm not grateful for the opportunities that have allowed me to have an amazingly fun career. But it wasn't always like that. And I think stories from people who look fabulous online and perhaps even have a little tiny bit of a profile, they're useful for the real story to be revealed to help you understand that everyone is human. But there might be little gems of knowledge that I can share with you that might be helping you on your little pathway. Now, the other part, if you came across me now, you probably see me wearing a suit, or you might see me as a bit of adventurer. Over the years, a few people know that I do love to trek and I like climbing up mountains and I like going off the beaten track, literally and physically. And that idea of being a little bit fearless and being bold is something that started not when I was like 6 or 7 or 10 or what have you. It actually started much, much later in my life. And I'm going to explain a bit about why I love to try new things now with almost an obsessive passion. So let me take you right back to Westlake Shore Primary School. For those of you locals, Westlake Shore Primary School is nestled down by the beach, and I was lucky enough to join the very first group of year ones when the school was open. And the school was very, very cool. It was nestled in between Port Adelaide and the very, very spunky Dolphin Island. And when I was in year five, I look at a photo of myself when I was in year five, and I was the tall girl. I was the tallest girl in school. And for those of you who know what it's like to be the tallest girl in school, you know that it is definitely not something that the label you want to have when you're in year five. I also had terrible teeth, really bad teeth. And I was also a little bit awkward because when I was in year five, my backdrop of home was very tough. My parents were going through an absolutely terrible divorce, and one where they were pitted against each other and completely filled with hate and animosity and what have you. And even to this day, all these years later, there's still what I think is just unnecessary friction between the pair of them. But it was really tough. It was really tough. And I remember thinking, why can't I just fit in? And I look at one of those photos, one of my school photos from year five, and I'm looking at it, and there's all these kids in school uniforms with fresh faces and pigtails, literally pigtails with ribbons. And I'm standing at the back, a little bit dishevelled, haircut at home, terribly crooked teeth. And I've got this wind sheeter on with Australia, emblazoned on the front. And, oh, my God, I loved that shirt. We didn't have much. I'm not going to play one of the poor games or anything like that. But we were, like lots of families, going through transitions of divorce and stuff. Money wasn't flush. So anything we did have, I valued. And, oh, my God, I loved that wind sheeter. But in their school photo, everyone else has got a school uniform, but I haven't. And I felt the complete friction of being different. And it was something that I hated. I stood at the back and I just felt this incredible sense of discomfort of who I was. And all I wanted to do so badly was to fit in, just fit in, just be like everyone else. And you don't have to be a psychologist to figure out that it was more than the wind sheeter that I was aching for. But like most things, you move on in life, and a couple of years later I look at a school photo and guess what? I'm still at the back of the class. I still have bad teeth, not quite as bad. I've now taken to cutting my own hair because the crooked fringe that my mother gave me in the kitchen was something I was going to do myself. But it's interesting when you look at the photos of the year sevens now, my school photo, all the school uniforms except for one have been abandoned and been replaced with like colourful wind sheeters and funky bubblegum jeans and groovy mullet hairdos and what have you. And we were beginning to discover our individuality. And I look at the two, they're so stark and so obvious, but we were top of the school. And we'd started to, within the safety of being, you know, having authority and having power and all of those things within the funny little construct of a Westlakes primary school environment, I started to figure out that individuality was good. And I understand now that it was within the safety of being, you know, the year sevens and I could pick on everyone else, that I was starting to get comfortable with the differences of who I was. But it was really hard to come to that process. And it didn't really last. I went through my high school years. I sort of went, you know, between, you know, wanting to fit in and then not fitting in. I fell in love or sort of thought I did and then I didn't. I shaved my head. My father will tell you I had a terribly punk head, too much to his embarrassment. But for me, school had always been an incredible refuge, where I could go exercise my brain and express my individuality while I was sort of growing and evolving. And I got to tell you, even though it was a bit of a rough start, I was always an optimistic child, an optimistic teenager, and I always thought that the, you know, with just good hard work and applying yourself, that good things would happen. And I learned very quickly that hard work would result in success. So I did all that. I worked hard. Gee, I worked hard. I put myself through university, you know, taking hold of the violins. I'm in South Australia, for goodness sake. It was just a matter of working hard, getting the right results, and then getting in to tertiary education. Then I found myself in Telstra, and I was lucky enough to get into this job. And for the little girl from Westlake Shore, the crooked teeth, Telstra was just like an incredible opportunity for me. I was over in Curry Street. I rapidly got promoted through hard work. I worked hard and I ended up running one of the biggest portfolios here in South Australia on behalf of Telstra. But, you know, it's funny with people. I was just starting off in my career and the ache of what was going to happen next was always burning in me. The curiosity had been lit in me. And I stayed at Telstra for a number of years, gained a great reputation. And I gained such a great reputation that one day the phone rang, and I'll never forget it because I was walking down Curry Street with my tic-tac, I think it was a tic-tac Motorola phone, and I took a phone call. And at the end of the phone call was, it was a man from IBM, International Business Machines, one of the world's biggest computer organisations, and one that I had actually studied. And here was this man, the voice of IBM. But more than that, this man at the other end of the phone said, Marina Pullen, we've heard you're really good. You're really good. And we want you. Now, for anyone who has ever experienced hearing someone say that they want you, you know how incredibly intoxicating it is. Even the most humble person can't help but swoon a little bit. But when you add that to the equation that someone like IBM, who was my hero, if there was such a hero in an IT tech field, had actually headhunted little old me from Semaphore Park with the funny windcheater and the crooked teeth, I just can't tell you the feeling. Even if they'd hung up and said, oh, it was a mistake, it wouldn't matter, because for that moment I felt so wanted and I felt so incredibly desired. So I went to IBM, Telstra, I learnt lessons because Telstra got into a bidding war and they decided well, they wanted to give me more money, but my heart was gone. My heart was gone to a new adventure at IBM. So I started at IBM and marched into this incredible world. This was a company who had history, long, long history. They had started, I still remember Valentine's Day, February the 14th, and I loved the philosophy of IBM. They believed in quality, and I was so proud of my company because it was the only company that I knew of that always held a door open for anyone who had a Nobel Prize or had been considered for a Nobel Prize in the areas of technology and innovation. There was always a seat at IBM for you. So I worked in Sydney and I got to work in warehouses with funky mainframes and with scientists and all sorts of incredible things. And to say I fell in love with this company that had just for a moment expressed a desire of me was an understatement. I absolutely and totally bled blue. And I found that within the safety of that, I blossomed. I knew they wanted me. I had some power and I had a little bit of authority and I prospered. I had the CEO of Asia Pacific, IBM, pick me out. He picked me out to be his mentee, and I was personally mentored by the IBM's CEO, and I got to see the insides out of what it means to run one of the most extraordinary companies of the world. And I achieved goals, and I did all sorts of wonderful things. And what I didn't know when I was doing that I was at risk of violating other rules. And I did. I violated the rules of seniority and hierarchy, and that you don't do that if you're from Australia, and definitely you don't do it from Adelaide, and you must never do it if you're the only female on a ratio of one female to every 100 men. You must never show anyone else up. But I didn't know that. I was just that girl from Sevenfold Park who said, if you work hard, you'll give it a crack, and onwards we went. But I did. I violated and broke so many rules by accident, whilst also receiving the pats on the head from leadership. And then the harassment started. There's a little bit of dribble, a few coming, you know, a bit of like cutting comments. And then I started to be excluded from meetings. And then the harassment started to move into outright sexual harassment. Lewd comments who were designed to completely undermine my intelligence or my, you know, my accomplishments. Whatever it was, to be able to keep and reinstate the norms that, you know, girls like you shouldn't be doing stuff like this. And now the harassment, I wish I could tell you that the story ended with me becoming victorious and all of that stuff, but it didn't. What it did end up with in a full-blown investigation, and I did one of the biggest mistakes of my career, is that they found the people guilty. I did, yeah, just like a proper IBM thorough quality, all of that stuff. And I remember the pivotal moment when HR said to me, so what do you want to do with these people? Do you want us to fire them? Or do you want us to just sort of patch it over? And I made one of the biggest mistakes of my career. And I said, oh, I'm sure if they've been told it's the wrong thing to do, just let them stay. And for those of you who have endured workplace harassment, you know, that was one of the dumbest things you can say. I should have said, sack their sorry asses. You're not allowed to do that to people. But I didn't. And the harassment then changed. It just became a little bit more in the shadows. It became harder. And then they had more ammunition because I'd violated another set of social norms. And I ended up having to leave IBM. And it was one of the most heartbreaking moments that I had to leave my career, my dream and all of that and start something new. Now, the something new, it's funny because, you know, if you believe in Star Wars and all that stuff, you know, then and I think sometimes recruiters out there are part of the Jedi area. And someone came and knocked on my, I remember that they're in the car park of IBM and they said, we hear, you know, the force has moved. We hear you're interested in looking at other things. And so they offered this job. And the title got me. I sound like I'm a bit shallow, but the title was, we'd like you to come on as a business improvement manager. Now, with the holes in my heart and everything I saw wrong over it, you know, my dream job, I was ready to save the world. So I picked up, swaddled, jumped on my white horse and went, yeah, let's do this. Still grieving the loss of a career that I could have had that should have taken me to New York. But I decided, you know, like so many of us, I thought, I'll just give it a go. I'll see if I can do it. And I did. And I went down and became, I joined EDS and I went through and it was an extraordinary experience through a whole series of weird promotions, people resigning, people being sacked. I found myself in the acting role of director of business process. And I got to tell you, it was a job that was totally beyond my skill set. And has been responsible for me being so aggressively chasing down skills because I felt that pain of not knowing what the hell I was doing every single day. But I knew the importance of my job, but I didn't know how to do it. And it all came to a head when I was one of the most pivotal moments in my career that has shaped MCBI enormously is I was asked, I had a seat at a boardroom. And I walked into this boardroom, and it won't surprise you, there were lots of blue suits in there. Not a lot of skirts, but there were lots of blue suits. And I walk in and I took my place as someone who was there to to represent re-engineering. Now, for those of you who know the sector, re-engineering is a fancy name for getting rid of staff and trying to make businesses stitch together and keep processes going as best you can before you actually break an organisation. Well, that's what it was back then. And I sat down, we went through, and we had heard that we had cost-saving targets that we'd already sent off to the States because our bosses were in the States. And I was, you know, we were just being given the targets and how we were going to improve productivity. It was an incredibly blunt way to run an organisation. And whilst on the outside we were promoting innovation, it was nothing like my experience from IBM. This was just hard yards commercial. And I sat there and I looked up on this big screen surrounded by blue suits, still with a little bit of, you know, hope in my eyes that the world would be a better place. And I'm pretty good at math. And I looked up at this Excel spreadsheet. And just very quickly, I looked at it and went, oh, there's a mistake on line whatever it was. No, the calculation. We're talking year 10 calculations. For those of you who know this, the extrapolation of FTE and productive hours. And then we sort of, you know, in a really blunt way, coarse way, multiply it out to figure out how many FTE, which is fancy word for people, that we were able to let go. But this calculation was wrong. And you could see that it was wrong. And in my Semaphore Park naivety, I pointed it out. And I said, but that's wrong. That's like 41 people's jobs. That's wrong. You just got to tell them. And I fully expected, just like that naive girl who looked at the HR person and said, yeah, no worries, I'm sure they'll be fine. I fully expected them to go, oh my God, quick, fix it, change it. We can't let 41 South Australians lose their jobs because of an Excel error. But I was wrong. Because the commitment had already been made. This wasn't a negotiation. This was a confirmation of what we were going to do. And I remember just looking around at these people and no one really making eye contact because all of us knew what had gone on. And there was this one other man who I looked at, and let's call him Ross, because his name is Ross, and Ross deserves to be known. Because Ross looked at me and he and I locked eyes, and because I didn't have anything to lose, I went, that's just not right. Because they're not just numbers. They're not numbers, they're not like people, you know, they're not like FTE, some abstract level. I can tell you because I'm a hardworking person who actually makes sure she knows her stuff. Those 41 people, 67% of them are women. Most of them don't even have a high school credential and they're unlikely to find a job down in the western suburbs here of Adelaide. You can't do that. And Ross looked at me and egged me on with his eyes of going, no, I support you. And I won't tell you what else went on in there because some of it was commercial, some of it was fair, and some of it was probably just being clouded by the history of all this. But it was pivotal. And Ross and I both got up and walked out. Now, I don't judge those other people who stayed there. You know, they had mortgages, they had kids. You know, they made a decision, maybe consciously, maybe because it was just easy. I don't know. And I don't know. And I genuinely don't judge them. But Ross, he taught me a big lesson there. Because all he had to do was support me. And he looked at me and he stood up in solidarity for what we felt was the right thing. And he did. He and I walked out, we held our credibility together. And eventually he and I resigned from that assignment. But I've got to tell you, I wish I could tell you that it was like I was so honourable and I walked out and, you know, it was all like, la. But I did have a mortgage. So I stuck around for a little while. So I'd had my heart broken, but something else had been broken as well. My capacity to care what other people thought had been broken. Now that might sound negative, but if you're interested in understanding your talent and you're understanding where your potential lies, you must also know what shackles it. And caring what other people think is one of the worst shackles that you can possibly have. Now, I went on to a job, let's say I went for a job and I had to go do re-engineering for Commonwealth Bank, because I did work on the Commonwealth Bank account. And I had to go in there and try to fix stuff up, and I knew it was my last gig until I could figure out something else and get out of there. But I did that gig with utter fearlessness. I'd learned that if I just, you know, if I didn't give a toss, all my skills and my talent just came to the fore. And I learned one of the most powerful lessons, and I'm so grateful that I have it. Oh, God, I wish I hadn't got it the way I had. But I learned the power of just fearing less. Just fear less. Fear less than, you know, the people around that room. Fear less that things are going to, like, you know, not work out. You don't always have to be completely reckless and bold, but just fear a little bit less than you did yesterday. And the reason I say if you can, like, squeeze or compress or limit your fear in the vacuum, that's where your talent comes up. This sort of brazen talent emerged in me to become, I think, one of the most passionate, technically governed re-engineers around. You know, I'm very proud of my track record of what I've done, not just in from the commercial side, but also what I've been able to generate in terms of value on it in the most traditional way. But I wouldn't have been able to do it unless I'd learned the art of fearing less. So now, when the opportunity arose for me to climb a mountain, I was completely scared. And I thought of that little conservative girl who was worrying about her hair. And I thought, no, I'm just going to fear a little bit less. So I started with a small climb. And I never summited, so I'm not going to take that. But I did get to Everest. And that was a pretty cool thing. But I had to do it by little bits. And I just learned to fear less. That is my story. So my friends, you don't always have to just be the bold person on the lectern. All you have to do is just fear a little bit less.
Thanks for listening in today. We look forward to you joining us next time.